It is Friday, August 14th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the Senate adjourns as pandemic economic relief talks fall apart. Meanwhile, the Postal Service is under siege from within, as sorting machines across the country are decommissioned. Trump admits no funding for the post office if vote by mail goes forward. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren calls for an investigation into the new Postmaster General's recent purchase of Amazon stock options. Israel and the UAE announce the official normalization of relations. Texas coronavirus cases spike, but their data has crumbled. Meanwhile, the Greek military on high alert over tensions with Turkey. Sure, why not? Bloomberg and Kasich to get more speaking time at the DNC than AOC. Biden's national lead goes double digit. In 2020 alone, Trump launches more airstrikes in Somalia than Bush and Obama combined. And lastly, Donald Trump seemingly floats an Edward Snowden pardon. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I should also say, I neglected to headline this, just breaking. The Government Accountability Office, Accounting Office, GAO, has determined that both Chad Wolf and Ken Cuccinelli were not appointed as acting head of DHS and, I believe, CBP. They were not legally appointed to their positions. In other words, they're serving illegally. In other words, we should be rolling federal officers up on them and having them arrested. I don't know if that's actually a criminal offense. Nevertheless, I still think we should be doing that. They both have it coming to them. Welcome to the program. It is a casual Friday. Pandemic version. I hope people are well. Quite a week to look back on the program today. I neglected to say, I just realized, Alex Perrine will be joining us and Judy Gold will be here. Judy Gold has a new book. So I hope we've pulled the graphics for that. Matt and Brendan are here with us as well. I believe Jamie will be joining us in the fun half of the program today. Where we are in terms of any type of corona relief bill, the Senate has adjourned. They will come back if there is a deal. The negotiations are now going on between Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin. Although, and apparently, Mark Meadows has been sort of sent out of DC for the week. Because Meadows was certainly inhibiting the negotiations, is from what I've read in terms of the reporting. There are a lot of people who are suffering, and a new report out that shows exactly why there is such little urgency amongst the Republicans to do this. Now, Donald Trump is concerned from an election standpoint, but Washington Post has a piece that shows that the recession is over for the rich, but the working class is far from recovered. Jobs are fully back for the highest wage earners, but fewer than half the jobs lost this spring have returned for those making less than $20 an hour. This is according to a new labor data analysis by an economics professor at Brown University, John Friedman. Some economists are starting to call this a K-shaped recovery because of the diverging prospects for the rich and the poor. We're also seeing this disparity between white and minority households. We're also seeing this disparity between big and small businesses. And that is a function of the way that the CARES Act was structured and a function of the fact that we have now cut off any help or extra help to folks who lost their jobs. And this is, you know, part of the reason why there's such little urgency on the part of Republicans. And I don't know that Mitch McConnell, I mean, I don't know if people remember this. Well, we'll talk more about this with Perrine. But the other major sticking point in these negotiations is not only that the Democrats want more money for states and cities, they also want money for the post office. But Donald Trump doesn't want to give money for the post office because it will mean that more people have access to voting. That's not speculation at this point. Here is the president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow. What time of the day did he do this interview? Do we know? Is this a morning thing?
Yeah, this was yesterday morning.
Yesterday morning. All right. So he's probably, you know, sharper than he would be if it was, you know, after 12 noon. But here is Kudlow explaining why the talks fell apart. Because the Democrats, you're not going to believe the stuff that Democrats are asking for. Listen to this.
Whether or not, in terms of your first question, I don't think I really want to say much on that. We've acted, President Trump has acted forcefully because we couldn't reach a deal with the Democrats. They're asking too much money, $3.5 trillion. We've already spent over $3 trillion. So much of the Democratic asks are really liberal left wish lists. We don't want to have voting rights and aid to aliens rights. And so forth. That's not our game. President can't accept that kind of deal. Larry, so we'll wait and see on the negotiations. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin is working on that, but so far it's a...
I love the fact that nobody even bats an eye. Wait a second. Larry, did you just say that voting rights are just not your game? Don't you think you should maybe just sort of that, you know, at least give lip service to the whole voting rights thing?
That's how generous interviewers are with Kudlow, is just stumbling over the words. So you might as well, we know what he means. He means, you know, mail-in voting.
Yeah, Larry, we know what you're talking about. You just don't want you just don't want anybody in the blue states to be able to vote, right? I mean, that's basically what it is, right, Larry? Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
Exactly.
But, I mean, the fact is that is a huge part of what's going on here. And we'll talk more about this with Perrine. But what's happening with the Postal Service is just absolutely nuts. It's just absolutely nuts. We're getting reports out of Portland that they are scooping up extra mailboxes, which, I mean, maybe that's just, we had regular, you know, culling of the mailboxes that we're doing. They are decommissioning sorting machines. The Postal Service is telling Pennsylvania that we can't deliver all the ballots. We can't possibly do this. A federal judge has basically told the Trump administration, you need to give me proof of what you're asserting. And this is just posting this now. Multiple sources within the Postal Service told Motherboard they have personally witnessed the machines, which cost millions of dollars, being destroyed or thrown in the dumpster. These are sorting machines. They are removing more than 500 letter sorting machines nationwide, about 15% of its inventory. This is clearly a reduction in capacity, not a reallocation of machinery, as the USPS has publicly stated. Supposedly, the plan predates Louis DeJoy. But there's no doubt in my mind that these plans have been sitting around. How would you dismantle the post office? Well, we would start with this. Let's put that into effect. There's absolutely no reason to do what they're doing. There's just simply no, absolutely no reason during this, right now, to be doing what they're doing, other than to diminish the capacity of the post office. And look, if you have 100 million people, if you have half the people voting by mail, know that that is still, and they all do it on the same day, that is still less than the capacity on any given day of the U.S. Postal Service in terms of what they do in terms of delivering the mail. They can do this. We spoke to Mark Dimenstein last week, or I guess on Monday. Was that Monday?
That was Monday. Ago, yeah.
Where he basically just said, yeah, no, it's easy. That's what we do. We, you don't think that there's a surge at Christmas? You don't think there's more mail at Christmas than there would be with absentee ballots? That's nuts. Let me know when we got Alex on the line. In the meantime, I got to tell you, 2 or 3 months ago, I had tried some CBD tinctures, was not impressed. Didn't know much about the stuff. And in retrospect, I think it was a function of the dosage was, it was literally weak tea. About 2 or 3 months ago, I can't remember when it was, Sunset Lake CBD approached us. They are fans of the show. They wanted to advertise. They are located just outside of Burlington, Vermont. It was a family-owned dairy farm that was producing milk for Ben & Jerry's ice cream. They decided to diversify, started to grow hemp. They collaborate with the University of Vermont to work on regenerative agricultural practices. Their hemp is 100% pesticide-free. They only use organic fertilizers. On top of all that, their business practices, excellent. They've imposed their own $15 an hour minimum wage. Employees own the majority of the company. And their CBD products has made believers out of everyone here on the show. Now, I keep reporting back on this, and, you know, I'm very hesitant to make any broad claims about this stuff. I've been using it for sleep. That has been very helpful to me. But I get eczema sometimes on my hand, on my palms of my hand, on my ankles, and on my chest. And I've hit all three of those now over the course of the past 4 or 5 weeks. And I have used the tincture, and most recently, the salve that they sell with arnica and beeswax in it. And that's supposed to be for muscles and joints, but I've used it on my eczema. And I got to tell you, I cannot vouch for what would happen with anybody else. It works. And I know I sent some salve to a buddy of mine who had shingles, and it helped with his back. We got emails from people who say it helps with their arthritis. I'm loving their CBD coffee. That's my weekend coffee now drink. And Matt, who has always been a CBD smokable skeptic, is now, you're like their chief spokesperson. You're like their chief smokesperson. Sorry. I'm so
yeah. I don't know about that, but they did change my mind about smokable CBD. I had a terrible experience in Venice Beach, Los Angeles, that gave me a really bad headache, and I didn't understand why people would ever smoke CBD. But they've basically sent me a lot of it, an embarrassing amount of CBD, and I've been mixing it with stuff, and it's great. It's very good for relaxation purposes. And I just gave my girlfriend a foot massage last night with the Sunset Lake CBD hemp salve plus arnica, and I must say, good reviews there too. So
wow. That is going to resonate. I will tell you that right now. People are not going to be talking about your foot rubs for quite a while. Folks, go to sunsetlakecbd.com. Use the coupon code, one word, left is best. Left is best. You get 20% off. Left is best. sunsetlakecbd.com. Check out the gummies too. The gummy CBDs are delicious, and they have 1,000 milligrams. Is that what it is? MG? I don't know. And so check it all out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is best. One word, 20% off. Check it. Do we have Alex?
He's not here yet, no.
All right. Well, he's just sort of...
He said he would be joining us shortly a few minutes ago.
Well, all right.
With an exclamation point.
Let's play this ad, this Ed Markey ad. So Ed Markey, the a recent poll shows Ed Markey now up. Let's see. He's got a wide lead, apparently. This is a there's a 4.5-5% margin of error. But he is up almost 15 points in the poll in terms of the primary over Kennedy, which is making me very happy. Hopefully that will hold. And I think I'm not exactly sure what accounts for it. I think it's just, there is a change amongst Democratic primary voters where they want people seem to be voting based upon issues in these primaries more so than they have in the past. And, 5 months ago, Markey was only leading by 2 or 3 points. And I think just the more people found out about Kennedy and realized he is to the right of Markey, I think this is what's going on. And Markey just released a killer ad, that is, one of the best ads I feel like I've seen released in a long time, and particularly a politician who is of, the boomer generation. Here's this new Ed Markey ad. And of course, I love it just for his accent.
There's an invisible contract we all signed at birth. A promise. Every hour we work means longer days of freedom and security. It paved the road in your neighborhoods, and it added up to a country. But when crisis hit, Trump's government abandoned America. We asked what we could do for our country. They looked for what they could take. But there's a truth written in every history book. If you break the sacred contract, the people make a revolution. All across America, the essential people are demanding a new deal. Well, they call me the deal maker.
Ed Markey's desk was thrown out in the hall by the state house bosses. Markey's bill is now the law.
I'm Ed Markey. I'm running for Congress because I want to fight for the principles that I believe in. The bosses may tell me where to sit. No one tells me where to stand.
My father was a union leader. He taught me, don't beg for your rights, organize and take them. So in January, I was the first senator to write to Trump. I warned him we needed a plan. I talked to the Democrats and the Republicans. I told them, we've got to save the fishermen. A month later, we had $300 million for our fishing industry. Trump wanted to cheap out, but I helped negotiate $600 a week for any American struggling to find the next gig. They thought the son of a milkman couldn't learn the rules. I made new ones. I don't need to get on the phone and talk to lobbyists to know what working people think. I get on the streets and I listen.
I've got a question for 1 million people. Do you want to freeze the arms race?
put the deal on the table, but the people make it impossible to refuse. With 500 laws on the books, you think I'm going to stop now? They wish.
Green New Deal. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey introduced their Green New Deal
to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process.
We got to absolutely crush Donald Trump in November. But if we're going to end this era of chaos, that won't be enough. We got to make sure President Biden signs the Green New Deal. We can't wait.
We got to have folks in the United States Senate who are willing to stand up for working people. That's who Ed Markey is. I need Ed Markey in the United States Senate.
We asked what we could do for our country. We went out. We did it. With all due respect, it's time to start asking what your country can do for you.
That's like the third or fourth time I've watched that ad. And I got to tell you, it just gets more brilliant every time I watch it. I mean, the way that he is sewn together, sort of like the different generations of Democrats who have represented the left side of the party, the way that he basically dips in and uses, you know, the value of Obama and AOC, you know, almost juxtaposing them to each other. Even though that's, you know, they're not exactly on the same page, as it were. And just the idea that he's basically saying he's already talking about pressuring Joe Biden as president, while at the same time saying it's absolutely necessary that he becomes president. He is not only, you know, tweaking Kennedy off of the, you ask not what your country can do for you, what you can do for your country. He is also basically saying, you know, it's time for people to get material benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And he's working in stuff like essential workers. I mean, I just thought that was just a brilliant ad, to be honest with you. I never knew that he was known as the deal maker. I'm not sure I buy that.
He is now.
But he is now.
Deal maker.
He is now. And I also like the way that he pronounces organize.
That whole thing makes me feel like someone, he like the direction that the you know, director got was like, what is Ed like? And like, well, he really likes The Departed, but do it for politics or something.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. I was going to say, I thought his accent was a little over the top, but I don't know. I think he pulled it off. It really did sound like he's from Boston. Let's take we don't need to take a break, do we?
Nope, here it comes.
Alex Perrine? Alex, are you here?
I'm here.
I'm glad you were able to organize yourself and get here. Did you see that Markey ad?
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah. It's like, awesome. It's the best ad I've seen in years.
Right?
It made me want to like run through a brick wall for the guy. It's so funny.
Honestly, my first thought was like, God, wait, is it too late to nominate for him for president?
Yeah.
Like, do you really need to have an old guy? Let's.
It's pretty funny. It's like, he's just been an institution for so long. And like, and I've always known, he's like, oh, he's one of the good liberal ones, right? He's
right.
Like, you know, he's one of the good liberal senators, but like had no other thoughts about him. And then now that little Kennedy guy's after him, you're like, I got to defend Markey.
I think that's what the ad is designed to do, is to sort of like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, he does such a good job. That ad does such a good job of weaving in sort of like the new generation of Democrats and the sort of the value of like the old, you know, Democrats. And the way that he explains the Green New Deal without any details, but just sort of like contextualizes it.
Yeah. That's what I actually liked about it as political messaging, beyond just the like coolness of the ad, was that it actually like made arguments that I feel like, you know, we are always saying, why aren't Democrats making these arguments? Why aren't they phrasing things in these terms? And like in a short amount of time, it pretty efficiently did.
Yep. I should introduce you, Alex Perrine, ladies and gentlemen. You may remember him. He is the staff writer from The New Republic and the host of... Are you the co-host or the host?
Co-host.
Okay. Well, you're the host.
I hope
the host
Laura's
of the Politics of Everything on the New Republic podcast network.
Mm-hmm.
So, Alex, welcome. I hope you're well. We're checking in. Matt was like, you know, I feel like we're checking in on Alex every once a month just to see. It seems like you've trimmed back your hair, a wellness check. You've trimmed your beard. You've trimmed your hair a little bit. You're looking like
I've taken maybe a little bit more care of myself. So
that's good to hear. A lot of stuff happening this week. We had primaries on Tuesday. Ilhan Omar, of course, won. Mm-hmm. And in Minnesota, Tina Smith is going to be facing a guy named Jason Lewis, who is a lunatic. We have this one story on the primaries that all the members of the squad sort of crushed it in their primaries, despite what we were told was going to happen to them. I think, you know, if you had asked me in 2018, I would have said it's possible one or two of them could lose, you know, like Rashida Tlaib could lose I think they really have cemented their positions, and they've added to their numbers in terms of like that, this, you know, squad adjacent squad politicians. And then the other big thing out of that primary was, of course, you know, a guy like Jason Lewis, but also we're going to have our first full on QAnon representative.
Mm-hmm.
In Congress. I mean, I think it's Georgia's 14th district. She's not going to lose that. I don't want to spend too much time on that. And it's really like she herself is not that relevant, but I think it is like, we just keep seeing these waves, right? Like, I mean, this is like you would call them moral majority at one point. Mm-hmm. You would call them, you would call them, you know, Newt Gingrichites. Like each time they come back, and then they were Tea Partiers, and they come back, they take over more of the party.
Mm-hmm.
They move from the margins into the mainstream of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that replaces them is something even more virulent and insane.
Yeah.
So like, we're going to look back on Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan and these Freedom Caucus people is like, remember when Republicans were, you know, not completely talking about, you know, we're not talking about changelings and, pedophile pizza places or whatever it is. I think maybe if we get enough of those people in Congress, maybe we will start to see Democrats, you know, stop talking about the idea of negotiating with them and finding common ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Right. It's like, how can you even articulate a need to try to find a middle ground with like a QAnon person, right? Like you can't even really make the case, you know, like you can be like, I know how to sit down and talk to Mitch McConnell, but you can't do that with like, I know how to sit down and talk to someone who believes that, that John F. Kennedy Jr. is alive.
Right. Well, but I say that because what we're looking at in terms of what's going on with the post office right now,
right,
seems to me to be the most naked attempt. And Trump has, I think, like sort of like there's a lot of these, you know, attempts in, but this is a full on attempt to like legitimately interfere with the election.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, this is akin to we're going to break into some of the electronic voting things and just turn them off.
Right. Right. It's
happening in real time. We're watching it right now.
Yeah. And I think it's difficult to, I mean, I guess it's, yeah, it is hard to get across just how scary and dangerous it is. I mean, I don't know. I spent a lot of time last week reading as much news from Belarus as I could. And it's like, it's not impossible. America is not so exceptional that what happened in Belarus from 1994 to now is impossible, right? Like, they had free and fair elections in 1994 and then never again. And, like, there's nothing in the rule book that says a similar thing couldn't happen to the United States, which is not to say Trump is the guy who's going to do that. But I do think, like, that's what it makes me think. Like, we need to not just be complacent about thinking that, like, something resembling elections that are reasonably fair will continue to happen.
Well, I mean, there's two points you're bringing up there. And actually, like, I was thinking about the specific point you're making in terms of where this leads, right?
Yeah.
Like, with the concept of, like, the second mover agenda advantage, right? The first person to market has always basically just exposed the flaws for the second person to market. Right. And so, like, you know, Tom Cotton is just sitting there taking notes. This works. This doesn't
this
work.
This didn't.
That works. This doesn't work. Or or whomever.
Yeah.
But we just talked about a report where you have something like 10 to 15% of the letter sorting devices being not only taken offline, but destroyed.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Literally destroyed. And the post office has been lying about this. They've been saying, oh, we're redeploying them and putting them somewhere else.
Yeah.
When you destroy a major piece of millions of dollars of equipment, and you're doing this all around the country, I mean, it's quite clear what's going on here.
Yeah.
They are trying to diminish the capacity of the post office.
Yep.
I think it's like a twofer. I think there's some people, I think it's like, Paul Wolfowitz saying that, you know, weapons of mass destruction was the thing we could all agree on.
Right.
I think in this instance, you've got people like DeJoy, who is the new postmaster general, and he is heavily invested in all of these private, package delivery and mail services and has in Amazon and this and that. I think they're looking to privatize the post office on one hand. Mm-hmm. And I think from Trump's perspective, it's like, I don't want them to be able to mail in their ballots.
Yeah.
And the real question is like, what, because they're going to do what they're going to do. The question is like, what are the Democrats going to do? Like,
I don't know. Right.
Like, at what point does it become incumbent upon the Democrats to come out and say, and not just the Democrats, but, come out and say, like, you are making this election invalid? Like, right. At what point do we get there? I mean, I know this sounds a little bit like hyperbole, but I mean.
Right. I think it's really difficult to talk about all this without sounding hyperbolic, which is one reason I think a lot of elected Democrats don't know what to say or do, because they don't want to sound hysterical. They believe very much in rhetorical moderation and caution. They believe that's a virtue that sets them apart from the other side, is their caution. But this is not a time for that. And I don't know. I think someone was asking the other day, like, if we have a clearly illegitimate election in which Trump refuses to leave office and millions of ballots are lost or thrown out, then, what are Republicans going to do? And like my question is like, my worst fear here is that what Democrats are doing is preparing, like laying in the groundwork for like essentially fighting up until Bush v. Gore 2. Like, you can imagine a case in which like they have a legal, like they are preparing a legal fight that they could easily just lose in a corrupt fashion at the Supreme Court.
I agree. I mean, I don't see enough going on in terms of like you know, how are we going to do this in terms of raw power? How are we going to do this in terms of, like, you know, people bringing people on the streets? How are we going to set the predicate in the way that Trump is setting the predicate for his people, which is, you know, vote by mail is illicit. I mean, much of what they've been doing for the past year and a half is to is an attempt to delegitimize Trump loss. That's what all of the Burisma stuff was all about. That's why Bill Barr and Rudy Giuliani were going around the world, was not just to sort of say that the Comey investigation was illegitimate. They're going around trying to make the case that Ukraine was involved in this and they were actually supporting Clinton, and they're going to do the same thing with Biden. And that ran into an impeachment and it became a little bit less salient. In fact, totally less salient, although Ron Johnson seems to be trying to have hearings to that effect right now. But I mean, I'm not seeing, maybe they roll this out. I don't know when, but I mean, I'm not seeing this. I'm not seeing them do anything other than, like, I'm pretty sure the institutions can hold. You know what I mean? Like, they're just looking at the structure and they're saying, I think it's going to, they're, you know, instead of going and boarding up the windows and doing this, they're just going, like, I'm pretty sure this can hold.
Or they're like, this, you know, this can withstand these hurricane strength winds just long enough for an overwhelming electoral victory beyond any possible attempt to challenge it can bring us back to, like, then work on fixing up the things that are kind of looking shaky right now. Like, it just, they're like, in their minds, it's like, it just needs to hold long enough for this. And it's like, I mean, I don't know, like, this is worse. The fundamentals of how ballot casting will happen are being screwed with right now. Can you really put all of your, put all your chips on an overwhelming electoral victory that will be recognized as, I mean, I don't know.
I have to say that, you know, this week I've been toying with the idea of actually voting for Biden in a safe state. I mean, for this very reason, like, I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like there's some type of, it's for this reason, basically. It's just like, I don't want Donald Trump to stay in office. And, one vote in New York State is going to, you know, sort of add to that number. But I'm increasingly feeling like that's necessary, but insufficient, that there needs to be a couple other, you know, contingencies that are put out there by the Democrats. And I'm not seeing it yet. Let's talk a little bit about Kamala Harris. She's the VP pick. And I don't know. I don't think it was really a tremendous surprise in any way.
No. Last time we talked, this year I gave up on making predictions because I just don't want to be a person making predictions. But I think last time we talked, I said, like, I have thought since March Harris is the most likely for the same reasons now as in March, but the underlying justification might have changed, but the reasons are still pretty much the same.
Right. And I think that's I think that was the case. And I don't know. So what is your assessment of this? I mean, you go and then I'll you know.
I mean, I am not like, there was a part of me that felt like people like Rice were getting talked up just to make people like me, like, feel relieved when it was Harris.
You were saying that the other day. Yes.
And, but you know, I think it's, obviously frustrating now that we have this feeling that, like, the Democratic primary electorate, is, like, going to always remain, you know, it's going to, like, if we imagine they will continue to act as they did in the past, if in 2008, when Obama chose Biden, I would have been a lot more upset at his choice, knowing that many years later, Biden would be the Democratic nominee for president, because Biden, as we know, was like the conservative balance of the ticket back then.
Right.
With Harris, I'm like, you know, perfectly fine vice president. Probably I don't want her to be the next nominee. And like, this is the thing that makes me like, I was, you know, we were all sort of hoping we could move, and who knows what kind of politician she will evolve into, because she's already sort of had played many parts, I think. But you know, what I didn't like was the anointing of the next front runner. But we'll see how much the world changes in between now and whenever there's an open Democratic primary again.
And I think your point of we'll see how much she changes. I mean, it's sort of like David Dayan had a piece that was essentially like that. And my sense is, you know, I think Harris is not too dissimilar from Biden. I think they're both ciphers to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And yeah. They are. And I have to say that ciphers are like my second favorite type of politician.
They know. Yeah. Like knowing which way the wind is blowing is useful.
And particularly in this era. Right. I mean, and yeah. I think where we're headed, I would prefer someone who had some actual like legitimate interest in the politics of the day and where we're headed. Mm-hmm. Like Maki. but I think that at the very least, because she is going to be the presumptive front runner in 2024. I mean, it's conceivable that yeah. Joe Biden will be like, I want to do it again.
Yeah, it turns out.
Four more years.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling he's not going to be able to say that at the yeah. time. I mean, we should be so lucky that he'd still be able to say, even articulate that in four right. years from now. But she's going to be the presumptive front runner. And I think she has to know, based upon what I've perceived of her in terms of a politician, of like where this country is going to be in 4 years is going to be to the left of where mm-hmm. it is today in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, popular desires. And I think they're going to get a real mm-hmm. sense of that in the White House mm-hmm. if they win, like as early as like January 21st.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. Ed Markey, a sitting senator, is running in part, you see it in that ad, on pressuring President Biden.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't recall hearing that from the left. Like in fact, an incumbent, like, you hear Joe Manchin saying, like, you need me in office because I'm going to constrain Obama or right. whatever it is. Right. Or you hear like, I'm yeah. going to run because I'm to the right of Nancy Pelosi or something.
Right. Jesus. Yeah. You hear all these Democrats are always like, yeah, we're like, I'm not going to, you know, I'll fight against the Pelosi wing of the party, which is an insane thing. But that's
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. But that's been the rhetorical frame. I don't yeah. remember a time where an incumbent, particularly an incumbent senator, mm-hmm. ran on, you need me to push our next president to the left.
Yeah.
To push our Democratic president.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's indicative. I think that's what's so sharp about that ad, too, is mm-hmm. he knows where the Democratic primary electorate is.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some poll this week that, you know, Joe Biden, like 56% of people are voting for Joe Biden because they want to vote against Donald Trump.
Yeah.
That's their yeah. number one reason for, you know, which, I mean, that's his candidacy.
It is. That's what's his argument from day one.
But I think Harris will be aware of this mm-hmm. and will, I don't know if that they'll, like I say, cipher. She will move to the left, and at the very least, and she will try and head off any challenge to her from the left.
Well, you know, that was the funny thing about her candidacy, was that her candidacy was already an attempt to do that. That didn't work because, you know, the sort of people I would have appealed to already liked Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren more.
Yep.
But that was already her argument for her presidential campaign. So and I don't think that the logic of that kind of campaign will still make sense 4 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, she'll have to move to the left. I mean, she'll have to have some bona fides.
Yeah, right? She'll have to actually like demonstrate that she's taking it seriously.
and I guess we'll see. I mean,
because well, that's actually one of the remarkable things about the what feels like the Democratic primary electorate now is that like, is that they are, especially in I think the younger end of it, are like making these ideological distinctions, because like Kennedy's running on a like, I'm the insurgent progressive, and like I think we don't know what's going to happen in that election, but I think we have seen that's just not convincing anyone.
I think that's exactly right. That, I mean, that was my point, why I think that Markey's been able to open up a lead, because we have a Democratic primary electorate that is actually like digging in from an ideological perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're finding out like, wait, you're Kennedy, but you're to the right of this guy.
Yeah.
and that doesn't, you know, look, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I can tell you that like the knee jerk assumption about a Kennedy is that they are on the left margin of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to, and they're class traitors, and they're going to, you know, fight for the, you know, the average guy. I mean, it's just sort of like, you're just raised with that belief.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if the apple just, you know, falls from the tree, you know, as it gets further down, you know, generationally. But I think this is, you know, I think there's a certain amount of like poetry. If Kennedy loses, I think there's a certain amount of poetry involved in this. Right. I mean, I think it really is a good indication that we have left. Kennedy loses in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I think I'm spitballing here, but I think it could be the first time that a Kennedy has lost a race in Massachusetts for 60 years.
Yeah. That could be true.
Like,
I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe even more than that. Like, I think like Jack Kennedy may have lost, you know, his, you know, first attempt at Congress.
Yeah.
And I don't, I you know, maybe Ted lost a race. I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
And, I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And particularly losing because he's not to the left enough.
Yeah.
That is, I think that is a good, that could be a good thing. All right. Let's just talk about COVID relief for a moment.
Oh, God. Yeah.
You and I have no doubt several months ago when we were checking on you, back when you just, you had a little bit of stubble maybe at the time and you were clean cut. We said, what's the leverage to get the Republicans back to the table?
Yeah.
And now we know.
I think
there wasn't any.
I think we just saw. That's been the frustrating thing is like, you know, it's not like we were not like the only ones wise enough to see that. Like you could see other people, you could see plenty of other people being like, okay, but like, what are you going to do when you want to pass all this other stuff we need? What are you going to do?
I wonder if you were on, we played earlier in the week, the clip from Jake Tapper from April. Where he was like, but how, you know, and she said, we'll get to the state and city. Don't worry. We'll get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, if Jake Tapper is on it at that point, like, my feeling is that maybe this thing is pretty obvious to a lot of people. Yeah. And Pelosi may get there a little bit, but I, you know, look, you need to fund the post office.
Mm-hmm.
Because without funding the post office, I mean, that's Trump's whole game. If you don't fund the post office, they now have an excuse to go out and for whatever it is, spend money on decommissioning and destroying sorting machines and saying that they can't deliver ballots, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't see how they're going to get both funding for states and cities and defunding of the post office. I mean, funding for the post office. I don't see how that's going to happen. And the state and city thing, I mean, do you recall a couple of months ago, there was reporting, I think it was in Politico, maybe it was Axios, where Republican senators were saying, we're going to wait till Labor Day. And if Trump is still, you know, in a death rattle in, you know, after Labor Day, we're abandoning ship. Now, I'm not as I'm not quite as clear that they have the balls to do that.
No, right.
But I think that that's going to motivate what they're going to do. I mean, I think they may think in their mind, he's going to lose. Now, I may not come out against him.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly not going to help him. And the thing about not funding states and municipalities is that that's like, the Bruce Lee delayed kidney punch, right? You punch him and then 3 weeks later he dies of kidney failure. Like, we're going to feel the lack of municipal and state funding months from now.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to it has a ripple effect type of situation where people, they start cutting services, they start cutting workers. I mean, the big issue with the recovery back in 2008.
Yeah.
If you look at the recoveries, the Reagan and Bush 1 and Bush 2 recession recoveries,
mm-hmm.
the thing that always leads in those recoveries is hiring of state and city workers.
Yep.
And it was the Obama administration that did not provide that funding, and it lagged. And that is why we had such anemic growth for so long in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah.
It works the other way too. When you start getting cuts from these states and cities, that has downstream effects that are really going to dig these incredible holes across the country in terms of the economy. And that's going to be sitting in Joe Biden's lap. And I'm not convinced that Mitch McConnell's like, that's best case scenario for us.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting trying to figure out from the reporting what actually happened here, because basically it read like McConnell's just not involved. He's just going to let the White House figure it out and sign off on whatever the White House does, because he's torn between his incredibly ideological Republican senators who genuinely do not give a shit about state and local cuts, and the ones who need to get reelected this year, who are, I think, we're begging for a deal, and we're let the Democrats pass a deal with some of our support, but all they need was the White House to sign off on it. And so that in that scenario, it seems like a deal should be reachable. I cannot for the life of me figure out why, I guess,
Meadows,
state and local funding was the deal breaker. They were I think they could have gotten there on unemployment, but Meadows specifically was state and local funding, no way. And that seems at this point, I think if McConnell wants his caucus to survive, he's he should do something, right? What is he doing?
I think he's probably looking at the writing on the wall and saying, I can't save them.
I can't save this. Yeah.
I mean, this thing, I'll tell you one thing that we did not talk about in terms of Kamala Harris. I don't think that she's going to get, I don't know that she's going to win any state for Joe Biden that he wasn't going to win. I don't know that there's a lot of people who are going to come out and vote. She might be able to drive some African American vote in places Wisconsin or Michigan. But I'll tell you where I think she's really going to have an impact is with the African American community in places like Georgia, mm-hmm. South Carolina, mm-hmm. North Carolina, mm-hmm. Alabama. May or may not win any of those states. Maybe North Carolina is possible. Yeah. Georgia is possible. But you got Jamie Harrison in South Carolina in a tight race.
Mm-hmm.
You got Warnick in Georgia in a tight race against Loeffler. People forget that's two races in Georgia.
Yep.
There's Ossoff versus Perdue. That doesn't look so good.
Mm-hmm.
But Warnick versus Loeffler is getting a lot less attention.
Yeah.
And this guy, Warnock, he could win.
Yeah.
And Cal Cunningham in North Carolina against Tom Tillis, he's polling shows him out in front. I mean, mm-hmm. and so Kamala Harris is the type of, demographic. She speaks to women of color in those states, and can go in and drive votes there in a way that may not impact the presidential election, but could impact who takes the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that I think, Mitch McConnell could be looking at and going like, right now I'm happy to let Mark Meadows, you know, be the fall guy for crashing this whole thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I have a feeling that, you know, like to a certain extent, the White House is rudderless.
I think that's the only way to read what happened in these negotiations. I wrote a thing this week, basically, that was like, I think Meadows was just there to be a wrecker. Like, they didn't want Nuchin to get another deal. Like, they, meaning like Meadows and his ideological peers, did not want Nuchin to just cut another deal because Nuchin, he doesn't, all he cares about getting the money out. Like, he just wants the money out there. And, you know, it's funny because the Democrats picked the wrong time to stick to their guns. You know what I mean? Like, we talked about how when they had all this leverage, they left all this stuff on the table. And now they're like, no, we're actually really serious about the keeping unemployment the same way it was. And we're really serious about the state and local budgets. And like, that's correct. That was also what you should have been saying all along.
Look, I'm also not convinced because what you're expressing is that they're sort of like tactically have made a mistake, right?
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that they're also worried that Trump will actually do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they're going to say like their way of making Trump fall apart here is like either you come to us and give us what we have called for. Because anything less than that, you're going to get some credit for it, and we don't want you to get credit for it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That could be the dynamic. Meanwhile, you have millions of people out of work. You have millions of people who are facing eviction. Just it's
it's unbelievable how much unnecessary suffering is already happening and will happen. And man, you were right about the like. I'm just thinking about here in New York where, like. The governor does not want it. He doesn't want to raise taxes on rich people. Last thing he wants to do is raise taxes on rich people. Like, what the hell are we going to do? What is our budget going to look like? It's going to be terrible.
Terrible. And I got news for Andrew Cuomo. You can go and have the dinner with all these people out in the Hamptons, but they don't need to come back to New York City for you to tax them.
No.
Hamptons are in New York State.
Yeah, you can tax them there.
Exactly.
And then, like, we won't have to make, like, thousands of cuts in the Department of Sanitation budget in New York.
It's going to be nuts, but we'll see. Alex Breen, we will check in with you a little bit. Oh, I just got a text from Judy, Brendan, that Judy has not gotten her email with the Zoom information.
Do you want to share Judy's email over the Zoom call?
Well... text her and find out, because that could have been an old email. It was an AOL email. That could have been from decades ago. Literally decades ago. Let me just, since you've got school age kids, right?
He's three, so he won't be like real school age till pre-K next year.
So you're not dealing with this really?
No, I mean, I can't. I have friends who are, and it just seems like an impossible choice. I don't even really
it
know.
Is. Horrible.
Yeah.
It is horrible. And I think to a certain extent, a lot of people were just hoping that Cuomo would say no school.
Yeah.
So that at least you're like, you don't have this.
I don't have to
like,
make this decision. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's so difficult. And it's also like, you know, ones where like you're deciding for other people.
Yep.
Like, you know, am I going to send my kid in and is that going to, you know, is my kid going to be in school and am I going to be in some way responsible for a teacher getting ill. I just feel like this is, it really is sort of, it's stunning. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine in production who was, one of the few people in production who looked like he had a gig in North Carolina. His wife has a gig in Georgia on a big movie. And in the big movies, what they're doing is they're basically putting everybody into more or less camp.
Mm-hmm.
You come in, you get tested.
It's like the bubble, right?
And you're in the bubble.
Yeah.
Any other production, they're trying to test, but they cannot get the testing back in time.
Oh God. Yeah.
They can't get back in time. It's useless.
Yeah.
And they're all starting to go to Europe. Because in Europe, they do testing where you get the test back within 24 hours.
Yeah.
And we in America, we don't have the ability, apparently,
no,
to do this.
No,
it is so stunning.
Yeah.
And, I've made this call before to folks. If you know of a reporter, a European reporter who can come on the show and talk about what's going on out there, because we hear none of this.
No,
I don't think Americans realize.
I don't think Americans know either that how the rest of the world dealt with it and what life is like in other places right now. I just don't think Americans are aware of it.
No, I don't think they have any clue as to how poorly we have done on sort of the most basic, the most basic aspects of this. It really is stunning. Mm-hmm. That's the one nice thing about being an American. You never, ever hear when you are a total F-ups.
You never have to learn how much better everyone else has it.
Exactly. Alex Perrine, always a pleasure. Yep. Folks can find the Politics of Everything everywhere.
Yep.
Just about everywhere, right?
Everywhere podcasts are. Yep.
All right, great.
All right.
And, of course, check out your writing at The New Republic. Thanks again, Alex.
Of course, my pleasure.
We'll talk. We'll check back in you in a couple of weeks.
All right.
All right, folks. And next up. Oh, wait, before we bring her on, don't we have a little ditty?
Oh, play? Shoot. let me look for that as she's on now.
Oh, my God. She is really. Oh, that's awesome. Oh, wait.
I'm taking this picture out. Let's do that.
What are you put? What are you going to put in there? Have you been doing, ladies and gentlemen, Judy Gold? Judy Gold.
Your hair looks so good, even though I hate you right now.
Beb, where is that? Is that like a?
That's my house.
Oh my gosh!
I'm in Provincetown.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
Very fancy.
That is very fancy.
Didn't I got all dressed up for you?
Well, thank you, Judy. I really appreciate that.
Sam, I'm so proud.
You're a best-selling author now.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but
I mean, I would.
Okay, it's doing great. Sam, the hair is fucking excellent. Can we just talk about
my hair?
Your hair is so good.
Oh well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And you're an MSNBC star now.
thank you, Judy. That's very nice of you to say. Wait, can we get a graphic up of your book first? Let's put Brendan. Put that up there. I want to promote your book, not my hair. Although we'll go into my hair regime shortly.
Look how fancy I am! I have it on a Kleenex box right here.
It's too far away. I can't read it.
Mm-hmm.
There it is, folks. Judy Gold. Yes, I can say that. When they came for the comedians,
when they come.
Oh, when they come for the comedians, we're all in trouble. Now let's talk about this.
You're in this book. Yes.
I didn't get an advanced copy.
You know, look, I can't. I have kids.
I have kids. Your kids are grown. Your kids are grown. All your kids do is do work around the house now.
That is so not true. One plays basketball for Tulane.
Wow.
Yeah. I have a Division I athlete that came out of my body.
That's
and
amazing.
The other one is works at the Drew Barrymore show.
That's it works at the Drew Barrymore show?
Yes. Yes.
Drew Barrymore has a show?
Yes. She's going to have a new morning show, which, you know, it's perfect timing with the Ellen debacle.
Well, wait a second. So how does somebody do a show?
So they have, as far as I know, they have a whole virtual studio. Like there's no studio audience, but the entire studio is being used. And they have a virtual audience. So she'll always have an audience there. Virtual. So I don't know. You know what? I don't know. I'm just trying to sell my book.
Well, tell me about the book. What's the deal with the book?
Oh, God. This Zoom is the worst. It's like, as my friend Maddie said, we've never looked worse and never had to look at ourselves more. It's so fucking annoying. Anyway.
Yes.
So the book is called Yes, I Can Say That. When they come for the comedians, we're all in trouble. First of all, where's my fucking theme song?
Matt?
Seriously, Matt.
Here it is. I didn't know you wanted it still, so here
yeah, of
it is.
Course.
What the fuck?
Vamping for
does
that.
Does anyone else have a theme song?
Very few people.
I know.
Level-headed.
Fuck you!
Calm, cool, and collected.
I have a bigger penis than him.
Judy Gold is on the line to keep us all connected.
What the fuck is the matter with him?
A steady hand to guide us. She'll keep us calm and carry on.
No fucking way!
Too bad Jimmy Reefer Cuck didn't find her worthy of a song. Well, Judy Gold.
And he's such a fucking penis head liar. I'm not kidding. That's the president of the United States. That's the president. What the fuck?
You know, it is so catchy.
It is very catchy.
And I use it for my mindful meditation in the morning.
I bet you do. I was just, it's been sort of shocking how timeless it is too.
You know, I know we're supposed to talk about my book, but I can't fucking, like, you thought it couldn't get worse. You thought there was no way that the post office, you fucking piece of orange shit. How great was that guy yesterday who was like, how do you feel about the thousands of lies you've told in the last 3.5 years?
It would have been nice if there were other like the next reporter that Trump, Trump ignored.
Yeah, but the other, I know, he ignored it. And then the next one had no penis. So he's like, I want to ask about so I have this book. Yes, I can say that. When they come for the comedians, we're all in trouble. And it's about free speech from the perspective of a comedian and how laughter and satire and humor is so important because we tell the fucking truth and stop being offended.
But that's not always true.
Okay, Sam, can I sell a fucking book? Seriously.
Listen, I everyone should read this book. There's no doubt about it. But I mean, everyone doesn't have to agree with the entire premise, do they?
You can't. You cannot. First of all, a comedian gets on stage for what reason? To make you laugh. When you take intent, context, and nuance out of that formula, that's it. There's
okay. Wait a second. I don't want to race through that. So intent, context, and formula out of
and nuance.
And nuance out of that. But that's not always the case, right?
Right. I mean, but look, we've all gotten in trouble because people don't get nuance. But when you murder someone and you are on trial for homicide, your sentence is determined by your intent. And yet, people don't give comedians the same consideration.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I mean, certainly, like, in my own experience, I think it was quite clear.
Exactly.
What my satirical joke was. I was not actually calling for my daughter to...
Right, and it's in the book. It's in the book.
There you go.
It's
in the book. You can read about that in the book.
But you got... so much backlash over a fucking joke. This motherfucker says whatever the fuck he wants. Pocahontas, she's a nasty. He's a fucking liar. He's dumb. He has no curiosity. He's a con artist. He's disgusting on so many levels. He wants SNL investigated. He can't have a comedian at the White House Correspondents' Center. He can't even go to the White House Correspondents' Center because his fucking orange skin is so fucking thin. His little mushroom dick is so tiny. And yet comedians are getting canceled and this motherfucker says whatever the fuck he wants. No. N-O.
Now, wait a second. Now, who's getting canceled? Like, what comedians are getting canceled that you think, let me put it this way. What is it? First of all,
Kathy Griffin. Kathy Griffin.
When she held up the presidential, when she held up his.
Yeah, head. The thing. Now, do you think Kathy Griffin, who to this day cannot answer her phone because all the threats and yeah. If she posted that photo today, do you think it would be the same backlash with the amount of people that motherfucker's killed?
Probably not.
Right. Right. Okay. So Samantha Bee has had to apologize. Stephen Colbert has had to apologize.
For what?
He did a joke about Putin and like a blowjob-ish or a dick joke or a dick, you know, so he had a, but his apology was Great. Samantha Bee calling her a, calling Yvonne cunt a feckless cunt, which, I mean, their apologies were nuanced, but they had to apologize. I mean, we're comedians. We're comedians.
But this also goes, I mean, it's one thing, like, you know, like, is that cancel culture? I mean, are they like, what is, I mean, just weigh into this whole, like, cancel culture. Like, on one level, like, what you're talking about is akin to the Smother Brothers getting canceled.
They're in there, baby.
Okay, well, getting canceled by, because of, they were mocking Nixon.
Right. And Johnson. Johnson was really upset about it. But you know what? Johnson, when they were canceled, well, they were really fired. Because Lyndon Johnson was friends with the head of CBS, but that's a whole other thing. But when they were canceled, Johnson wrote them a letter saying, look, I know it wasn't easy for me being fodder for your show, but that's why this country is great. It's part of my job. It's not the funnest part of my job, but I wish you well, and I wish you the best, and it was my honor to be... Can you imagine this fat, orange, lying, golf fuck, asshole piece of shit ever doing that?
No. And right. And I have a problem with it, when, particularly when this comes from government. Right. And look, when it comes from corporations, that's the price you pay.
Right. I have that in the book.
Of a corporation.
Right. Like, that's correct. You know,
I, it's hard for me to imagine ever working in a full-time capacity for even like a place like MSNBC successfully for an extended period of time, because I'm going to say stuff, I think, that a corporation is probably not going to want to be associated with.
Right.
And it's like, okay, you know, you fire me because of that. That's your business.
That's fine. I mean, right. But it's like you sign a contract, you want the money. So you're like, all right, I won't do that. But you know, like you will love this book. I'm coming on after you read the book because you're going to fucking love it. But Gilbert, okay? Gilbert gets fired from Aflac, right?
Oh, Gilbert Gottfried, right.
Right, because he was doing tsunami jokes. And, you know, the story is in the book. I interviewed him. And it is... He said, you know, first of all, Twitter was new. I'm getting... All my fans are like, are you going to make a joke? Because that's what he's known for, making inappropriate jokes. So he's like, oh, sure. What happened? Oh, okay. He sent, you know, he does these jokes. He finds out he's fired on Twitter. And that night he's watching the news and he says the newscaster's talking about the tsunami and, you know, the destruction and the death and how horrible it is. And then the guy says, and to make matters worse, Gilbert Gottfried. And Gilbert said, with my stupid joke, I made it worse than it already was. You know, he's like, I didn't even know I had that power or that I was that important. It's like,
well, that part is ridiculous. But the part that he gets fired by Aflac, I mean, it's a business.
I get it. That's in the book. That is in the book. If you work for a corporation, you have to. But they should have done their due diligence as well
when they hired him.
Yes.
Well, I mean, screw that. He wants the money. He doesn't. Right. I don't want him to do the due diligence.
Right.
And if somebody's going to hire me for something that I'm ultimately going to get fired for, I don't want him to do the due diligence. I'll take the money for those 6 months, and then I'll get fired.
You're such a white, entitled prick.
Who, me? Yeah. Well, I mean.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay. So now, are there examples where someone should be fired? Where you feel like, didn't you write something, or wasn't there some hubbub about you saying that the guy, and I don't know really too much of the story about that SNL guy.
I know. And he
who's that guy?
It's Shane Gillis, and he doesn't want me talking about it, which, you know, I understand, but unfortunately journalists
keep asking you about it.
Right. Here's an example of nuance. Shane is funny. He's, you know, he had this great opportunity. They found this podcast where he's, you know, I didn't know, but he's playing a character, but I didn't know that because I listened to it a few times, twice, I listened to the whole thing. And, you know, as I've since I've wrote that article, and I really wrote that article as a love, you know, and a defense of comedy. And the fact that here he is working for a corporation. That's exactly what my article was about. I never say he shouldn't be able to say whatever he said.
So wait, he was doing a character. You got to tell me a little bit more of the story. Because
okay, so he does a character. He has a podcast, and they were doing a bit, I guess, about going to Chinatown. They were using, you know, not great words.
Right. Is it obvious that he's doing a character, or is it?
I didn't know. I honestly did not know it was a character. I thought it was two guys just. Whatever.
I mean, someone could stumble on Ken, Ken, and Ken.
Right.
Michael and I used to do.
Right.
And go like, oh my God.
Right.
What are they saying?
Right.
And who are these guys?
Right. So I wrote this saying, you know, he's funny and he should be able to do stand up, but they were saying it was political correctness, but it was not. It was the corporation. It was this corporate, you know, I work for a company and now I don't have that freedom anymore. And so I think the article was very nuanced, yet people just attack me for that all the time and say I'm a hypocrite. But, you know, Shane said he was pushing boundaries, and I, you know, had been in the process of writing this book and was reading about Lenny Bruce and George Carlin and, you know, Richard Pryor and all those who really did push boundaries and were jailed. And right. I mean, Lenny, his life ended over this. And I just felt that those weren't the correct words to use.
I am with you. I mean, this used to be, you know, this notion of like, people railing against, the idea that, I don't know, my feeling is this, is like, you can do, and Lenny Bruce, the idea like Lenny Bruce would go and work for like, I'm going to do a Campbell's soup commercial.
Right.
Well, I got news for you, Chief.
No, you're not.
You're going to probably get in some hot water. You're not going to.
Pun intended. Right. Campbell's soup, hot water.
But the, you know, but and he couldn't get on, you know, we've seen that before, like, you know, Kinison couldn't get on, I can't remember his name now.
Are you going through menopause?
Believe me, on top of all everything else.
I know.
No, not Kinison, but Hicks. Hicks couldn't.
Hicks is in the book. Stern is in the book. I mean.
And part of the reason why they all just stuck, with stand up was because they wanted the freedom to be able to do their art, and they figured out a way of making money on it. And you didn't want to go on to a sitcom or something else like that, because then you're constrained. I mean, that's
right.
This is the thing that I don't understand. Like, people don't realize, like, the reason why they pay you this money is not because you know, like, there are a lot of people out there who are talented, but they're very rarely going to use all your talent. What they're going to do is they're paying you money to stay within their boundary.
Yes. And for them to control you, essentially. So it's like, you know, I've been canceled. I got canceled twice last year from gigs because of one said I don't know if you know, I'm gay. I've never mentioned it before, but I'm a lesbian.
Seriously?
Yeah, I'm really good at it. Been this way forever.
Right.
I could give you pointers, I bet, but your hair is, you know.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, you must skip. All right. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. No, anyway, but, you know, I had people, now I do jokes about everyone. Everyone's equal opportunity. I've been called anti-trans. I mean, the last thing I am is anti-trans. But I do a joke about everyone. It's like your being offended is a choice. It is a choice. If you can say, oh, I don't like that joke, that offends me, and move on with your fucking life. Or you can let it control you and you want to stop that comic from ever working again because of one fucking joke. When, you know, if your favorite songwriter writes a song you don't like, do you say, fuck them, they should never work again? Do you go to an art exhibit and you like all the paintings except for one and think that person should never be able to paint again? This is what the fuck is going on. And it's, I got canceled from the Huntington Jewish Center because they said we're not singing from the same songbook because I guess they're Trump supporters. I thought there was one Jewy songbook, but I guess there's more than one. This idea that you can't enjoy this person's art because you don't agree with them politically is beyond.
But your art is not apolitical.
Right.
I mean, there's plenty of conservatives who think I'm funny. I don't want to hang this painting in my house. And if enough people say that, then like it's just you're just one of those artists who didn't connect with people.
Okay, but you can still paint. When you're a comedian, you need to an audience to do your art.
Well, but look, you can find an audience. It's just you're not going to find it at the Huntington Jewish Community Center.
Or you're not going to find it, period. You don't know.
Who's been canceled? What comedian had an audience and then can't get a gig? Who?
Bill Cosby.
Well, okay. Although,
oh my God, I cracked myself up.
Is he in jail now? Is he in jail?
He's in jail, so he probably has an audience. He has an audience.
I bet you he does.
Yeah.
I bet you he has a very rapt audience.
Yeah. Was Michael Richards, does he have an audience?
Was he doing stand-up that much? I mean, was he a particular good stand-up?
I remember.
I think
love all these people.
I think it's hard.
Who decide they can do stand-up.
Right. I mean, I think it's harder for famous people to get away with sort of walking the edge in a comedy club because it used to be, 25 years ago, if you were a well-known person, you walk into the Comedy Cellar at, 1 a.m, you could try out stuff that you could have total risk because, there's 15 people in the club and they're not going to go around. But now somebody's going to
forget
it.
Well, now
there's really millions of people in that club.
You're not allowed to bring your phone in that club anymore. But that doesn't stop someone from leaving the club and saying this one did a joke and it was racist or homophobic or.
But who though has honestly suffered but. Because you and I agree, you work for a corporation. You cannot expect that you're going to have your full artistic abilities. You're not going to be able to exercise your full artistic abilities because you've decided to commodify it.
Right.
And commodify it in the most extreme way. That's a choice that people can make.
Right.
That's up to them.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the terms. And I don't know. I remember when I was in Boston doing comedy, my parents called me and go like, oh, the Temple Brotherhood had Lenny Clark in and everyone was very upset. He came to like the Aku
right,
and just Brenda just said Louis C.K. lost a lot of his
I write about him in the book too, but he still can perform. He can still perform.
He goes in and he sells out shows all around the world.
If you don't like him or you don't think he's funny because you know more about him, then don't go to the show, but don't say he can never do his art again.
But nobody, people can say he can never do his art again, but they can't make it so that he can't.
What about Woody Allen? What about Woody Allen?
Woody Allen still can do his art too.
In Spain.
Well, okay. But I can't,
Right.
That's just, it is, look, I don't know. I still have no sense of like what the reality of that situation is. But it's not like the guy's not able to go out and make movies. It's not like he's been jailed. It is he got on the wrong side of his audience. And I don't know. I think to a certain extent too, what's happening in the world is that there are, and I don't know if it's in the comedy world, but just broadly speaking, we have been living under a certain sort of like social regime, as it were, of where the boundaries have been and where the dynamics have been. People have succeeded under those rules, And now we have a situation where the rules are changing. Like,
there's some of that. It's not all that. Like, Nimesh Patel, who's a great comic, okay? Nimesh, I think. I always say it wrong. All right. He's in the book. He was doing a show at Columbia, does this really brilliant joke, and they cut his mic off and tell him to leave. They don't listen to...
Huh? They pay him?
No, I don't think so.
They should have paid him.
It's in the book. But Ahmed was doing a show in Florida. He opens his set with, any other Middle Easterners here? I don't know where exactly he's from. And they clap. And he said, it only takes one of us to tell a joke. The next night, he's getting ready for a show and the police walk in. Someone called the police on him. They felt threatened. I mean, this is fucking beyond.com ridiculous. And I wrote the book because they came to me because I was on a piece on Vice News. They were doing a piece about how college bookers are telling comedians what they can and cannot say on stage because they're protecting the students from hearing bad words or thinking. And I was the opposing view. And let me tell you something. What the fuck is this idea that you can never feel uncomfortable? That you have to be shielded? That you need a safe space? Let me tell you something. Every safe space has a door to the real world, and it's not fucking pretty. So, fuck.
My sense is that, look, there was the same dynamics that existed 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. The difference was that there was no ability for people to complain about it. So it was like, you can't come here and start talking about how, for instance, you cannot come and say that you can't say this stuff about Catholics. You can't say this stuff about Catholics. I mean, look at Lenny Bruce, right? Like, I mean, like,
but they got him on the cursing. I mean, they arrested him for cursing, but it was really what he was talking about.
But it was what really, he was talking about. Yeah. Right. And the point is that was the government and society basically narrowly tailoring everything. The difference was that there
wasn't
anybody.
Can you say tailoring one more time?
Yeah, I can. But the difference was that there was no sort of like means in which the rest of the culture could respond to that.
Right.
And what has happened is it's flipped. The power dynamic, at least in terms of like within the culture, has changed. And there are
new, I don't agree.
There's always been rules. There's always
right,
been rules.
But it's like this idea of, you know, I talked to Ira Glasser, who was the head of the ACLU. And I was like, why is it? Why does he get away with saying Pocahontas and grab the pussy? And it's power. It's power. And once you shut one person down and say, I don't want any conservative people speaking at my college, then they can come back and say, well, I don't want liberal people speaking at my college. And then who decides? The dean? Like,
but
who are you to put?
They've been saying that all along. They've been saying all
do
of those.
You think Don Rickles, one of my chapters, thank God Don Rickles is dead. How do you think he would be received?
I don't think he would be received well
right
now.
Right.
But do you think when Don Rickles was when Don Rickles was at his heyday that any of the comedians you've mentioned would even be allowed to be on stage? Do you think that someone named Patel would be allowed to be on stage? No way. No effing way. That's my point, is that the only thing that's changed, we have always had this culture that has limits and boundaries. The only thing that's changed is that what those boundaries were have shifted pretty dramatically in fairly short period of time.
I get it. But we've also decided words that mean one thing to me and mean something else to you. That means I can't say that word.
Well, you can say it.
And you can talk about anything as long as it's funny. Craft a fucking well-written joke. But don't you know, just because this word triggers you doesn't mean that I can't, you know, say, or this topic triggers you. That means, you know, you can't say it because it might offend one person in the audience. So that means no. That's what's happening.
But if I'm going to hire you to come play in front of my audience, you know, I have two choices. I can either say, Judy, please don't swear. When you come on to the Majority Report today, please don't say the F word. And you could say, I'm going to. And I'd say, you know what? I can't have it.
Then I would be like, what the fuck happened to you? Like, seriously.
But my point is that, like, it's you're not saying, like, that comedians necessarily have to be booked at the Huntington Jewish Community Center.
Right.
Like,
I'm not
all comedians. And it's,
but you already booked me. You booked me. You gave me a deposit. And then you read my Twitter feed, or the head of the men's club read your Twitter feed.
You keep the deposit, right? You got to keep
the deposit. They wanted the deposit back. I said, no fucking way. I can't even rebook.
You keep
the deposit. I can't even rebook that date. I lost that date. I had booked, you know, I didn't have time to get another booking for that date.
You got to get a bigger deposit is what it is, really.
I know, baby.
That's the name of the book show.
I know. Give me a bigger fucking deposit. And yes, I did say that, you fucking asshole.
What was the original name of the book? Was it To Get a
Bigger Deposit? Yes, I Can Say That, Fuck You If You Can't Take a Joke. And then they changed it to...
Is that really true?
Yes. And in some of the... when they first announced it, it was, you know, Fuck You If You Can't Take a Joke. But like F, number sign, whatever.
Right, right.
And then I got a new editor and she was like, you know, I really...
I got... The book form?
The book itself, yeah. But I like, I don't know. I mean, it's more me, Fuck You If You Can't Take a Joke. But maybe I'll get more work from it because it doesn't have fuck on the cover.
I mean, that's the point though, right?
Yes, it is, Sam. You know, you're very smart.
You're very
good looking and very smart. And annoying.
That's true. I mean, I certainly have been told the latter.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So you were filling in for Chris Hayes, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Which the one thing I find annoying about Chris, even though he's brilliant, is tight on all in. Okay. Were you nervous?
Was I nervous?
Yeah.
You know, the last time I had done that, at the 8 p.m. show, I filled in for him on Up with all with
Christmas. Yeah.
I don't know, like eight. But the last time I did it was for Olbermann. And
oh, right.
I did it like four or five times within like a course of like 3 or 4 weeks. The last time was like 4 days before he quit. I was so nervous doing that at that time. Like, I thought at one point I was having a heart attack.
No way.
On air.
And no way.
I think I said at the break to the guys, like, I think I'm having a heart attack. If I am, just keep the cameras rolling because this will be big on YouTube. And and it turned out I just had gas. I just had gas. But I wasn't that nervous in this situation.
Do you think that's because you're more comfortable with yourself and you don't give a shit? Like, I find...
I think part of it is that, like, you know, high stakes. I'm not going to get a show. I hate to break it to everybody, but I'm not getting a show and I'm not really looking for a show on MSNBC. And I'm not looking to be more of a contributor than I am. Like, it's fun to do. I enjoy it. I like the idea of saying that, like, I mean, to be honest, like, I like the idea of, like, looking back at my career and saying, I was on a sitcom with Vicki Lawrence.
Right.
And I hosted a cable news show.
Right.
There's not many people who could say that.
Right.
I like that part of it. And so I wasn't particularly nervous. I think I've gotten better at reading from doing the AM quickie, to be honest with you. And I didn't feel like the content, I didn't feel like I was at, I give myself like a B on the content side in terms of questions. I felt comfortable, but things got jumbled around so much with, we were supposed to have Sanders and there was a technical problem. And then there was a technical problem with Corey Bush. and we had the press conference beforehand, so all the scripts changed and this and that. But for the most part, I was comfortable. I wasn't that nervous.
Did you like when Rachel was like, "Oh, I haven't seen you since"?
That was pretty funny because I hadn't that was the one thing I hadn't even thought about.
Right.
So I was sort of surprised. You know, I've seen that handover sitting in that, you know, in that studio many times, but it's between Chris and her.
Right.
And one of those moments like, oh, she's talking to me. And then it was weird.
And I remember doing her show at Air America and you guys all at Air America. It was very fun. And she was so fucking smart. But
that's true.
Yeah. But you're all good at it. You're good at it.
Well, thank you, Judy. That's very sweet.
And maybe you're so handsome. Like, I don't get it. You know, we're not the best looking people. The Jews. Yeah,
I've had a lot of.
Oh my God, I can't believe she said that. What are you talking about? And yeah, you're lucky. You got the hair. You're smart. What the fuck? Are you getting a lot of? You're getting a lot of.
Oh, COVID's been very good to me.
Really?
No. What are you talking about?
I don't know. You can.
What are you doing with the book? Like, do you? You can't go in on
virtual. I literally, Sam. I sit here all day, and sometimes I have makeup on. Sometimes I do my hair, but I Zoom podcasts. I did the Today Show from here. Oh,
really?
I got bumped from.
Did you swear? Did you swear on the Today Show?
No.
Why?
You know, I know what's appropriate.
Right.
It's a network.
I understand.
Yeah. I got bumped from The View because of John Lewis's 4-month-long funeral.
Uh-huh. I mean,
which is fine because he deserves it, should go on and on and on. That man was fucking.
And they
incredible.
Never had you back.
They went on hiatus the fucking next
week. Those guys.
I mean, I have the luck.
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. I've been there. I have that same dynamic.
Yeah. Jew. That's the Jew thing.
Yeah.
And how are the kids?
Insane.
Yeah.
Totally.
I feel sorry. That's the thing. I'm going to do an episode of my podcast. With kids and to talk about COVID because we don't hear what they're thinking and what they're missing. It's like everyone's making these decisions for them. You know, what about what they have thoughts and feelings and ideas.
Maybe you should have Mylon.
I'll do it.
Well, we can talk about it. I try and keep her.
Oh God, what the fuck? Why you do that? And then you pull back. This is why you can't stay in a relationship.
That's also true.
Oh, maybe we'll. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, that was an idea for a moment, but it didn't last. So, Judy, well,
I want you to. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to buy your book.
Oh, do you not want me to send it to you?
No, I'm going to buy a book. I mean, the time for you to send it to me is already passed. I might as well buy it now. I mean.
Look, there was a fucking pandemic, and so half this shit that was supposed to get done didn't get done.
I understand. But I am very excited to read it. I forgot that I was in it.
Yeah, we had a whole thing. Yeah.
We did. We talked so long ago.
It was 2 years ago?
Oh my God.
A year and a half ago?
And this is a best-selling book.
It's doing well.
I'd call it a best-selling book. That's what I call it.
That's why I love you.
That's what I call it. It's a Majority Report bestseller.
That's right, baby. Can I tell you how many people come up to me after show? Remember when we used to do shows?
Yeah.
And would be like, I heard you on Majority Report when you're going back. You have loyal, amazing fans. Your fans are fucking great. But I am doing shows here in Provincetown twice a week.
Oh, so what do you do? Do you go do outdoor shows?
Outdoor shows.
What, just before you go, what are comedians doing right now? These outdoor shows?
Right. So I did in June when I was back in New York, I did a show at the Bel Air drive-in movie theater. I was standing on the back of a flatbed truck. The audio went into the car radio. So they laughed by flashing the light. So I'm like, I was doing stupid, like, hey, Audi. Hey, so what's your fucking problem? Someone needs an inspection.
That's surreal. Like, that is like a dystopic movie.
I know.
Laughing by flashing the lights.
I was like, I don't care. I just have to get this out. And then but they've been doing shows, the virtual shows suck, but they've been doing shows like on, at Central Park. Stand Up New York is doing them all over Prospect Park, Central Park. But here in Provincetown.
Is it still Carrie Hoffman?
No, he's been gone forever.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. Coffee Breathman. And so I'm working at the Crown and Anchor here. They have it's a club, but they have, it's like a complex. They have a restaurant and a, you know, I was going to say disco, but then I sound like I'm 87,000 years old. But so outdoor, they have an outdoor area by the pool and they set up a stage. The audience is 25 feet away. The maximum was 100, but now the Governor Baker said 50. So with the social distancing, they could fit maybe 85. And now it's going to be like in the 40s because he had to cut it in half. And now, but I don't care. I hate saying this because it's so anti me, but I feel grateful. Oh God, that was hard. That I get to perform twice a week.
Right.
In
That's
front
what I
of
think
people.
People don't understand. Like this is, it's aside from like a lot of comedians are hurting because of cash and musicians, the same situation. This is a living for people, but it's also, I think, you can play your music in your house. You can't really do your stand up
right.
in your house.
And
people are like for stand ups to go a week without performing, I don't think people fully appreciate this. It's like, I don't know, it's like that jogging junkie that you know that needs to jog every day.
Every single day. Otherwise, your muscles lose the, it's like not going to the gym. And also, it's interesting because
I don't do either, but.
You look, your arms look
good. I don't go to the gym. I don't do anything.
You have good genes. But it is the perfect storm for comedy because everyone's in the same boat.
Yeah.
And we need to laugh. And yet, here we are. Because that fucking piece of shit, orange fuckface. Take care.
Judy Gold, on that we should end. I appreciate it. And folks, please go buy the book. Where do you like people to buy it?
Well, I like people to buy wherever they're in a lot of bookstores, indie bookstores. If you go to my website, it's like you can get it at your favorite bookstore,
judygold.com. What is website is judygold.com?
Yeah, but just spelled the regular way. As you know, my Instagram and all that and Twitter is JEWDYGOLD because I'm a Jew. But my website is judygold.com. And then the audiobook was in the New York Times New and Noteworthy this past Sunday.
I bet. Oh, my God. Of course you should get the audiobook.
The audiobook is great because there's so much material in there of other comics that I use as examples. So I try to give the essence of their voice or delivery in. So, and people love it.
Oh,
I hate my voice.
That.
I'm not listening to it.
I got
to
hear that.
Yeah.
Judy Gold, I love you. Thanks so much.
I love you guys. Thank you for having me. You too. Bye.
Judy Gold, ladies and gentlemen, Judy Gold. Let's head into the fun half. It's going to be a truncated fun half today, but nevertheless, it will still be fun. Just a reminder, this program relies on you, our members, for support. You become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You not only support the free show, you get extra content every day. Don't forget amquickie.com. That you can sign up there for the free 6-7 minute every morning in your podcast server. Maybe we'll figure out a way of emailing it to people. That might be helpful too, actually. You can also get it on the app at majorityapp.com. Check it out there. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. I'm going to pour a little more for myself right now. Actually, this is the Maya Super Dark, but you also can get the Majority Report blend. Don't forget, check out Nomiki's show. You can find it at patreon.com/The Nomiki Show or youtube.com/The Nomiki Show. Nomiki is doing daily coverage at 3 p.m. next week of the DNC. So check that out. We'll remind you then, but go check out her stuff right now. Jamie, are you there? Hello?
Hello? It's me?
Yeah, Jamie.
All right.
Why is it like Jamie always is like on that quadrant and then moves up to that quadrant?
Is that anybody else? I'm not. It depends on the layout of your Zoom, I think, actually. Yeah, you guys are stacked one on top of each other for me.
I don't understand how Zoom makes decisions.
To the viewers, though, you guys are side by side.
Oh, is that right?
It's probably some
now, is,
sinister
the viewers,
algorithm.
Is Jamie right over there?
Let's yes. See.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Look. Yes, exactly. Jamie? Yep. Yes.
Well, Jamie, what's happening? You're looking the wrong way, Jamie.
You're still looking at the
not
computer,
on my
Sam.
Screen. Okay. Am I looking at you now?
No, look the other way, Jamie. There you go.
I feel like the Brady Bunch or something.
So, Jamie, tell me, what's up with what's going on with the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we had on the elusive Virgil Texas to talk about all of the letters that the old lefties from way back are sending to the young lefties to try to convince them to support Joe Biden, who they're really for, what they're doing, yada, yada. At the end, we make an endorsement. You got to listen to it to find out. And then today, we just released a bonus for our patrons, wherein we continue talking to Virgil about the coronavirus crisis, policies and how they may or may not benefit the working class, partying in these trying times, and much, much more. I should also say we have reached our goal of 1917 in terms of patrons. So anyone, yeah, y'all wait for the drop. So anyone who joined before we hit that number should be able to expect a little thank you card in the mail very soon.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And that really was our ideal number. So if anyone else joins and ruins our 1917, I'm calling the cops.
There you go.
Did you decide on that number?
Oh, you know, just calculations involving lots of different complicated things.
It's a numerology thing.
They like prime numbers, so it's...
It's math.
1917 a prime number?
19 and 17.
Oh.
You guys wouldn't understand the complex mathematical calculations that went into that. But yeah, we hit it. So that's pretty exciting.
Matt.
Yeah, on TMBS on Tuesday, we had Dr. Drew Mikhael, the Belfast-based researcher who lived in Beirut. He talks to us about the explosion in Beirut and the rage that's developed towards the ruling class there. A lot of anger, and it's just horrifying that ammonium nitrate blew up right next to the grain silo, which is, you know, not something you want to have happen during a pandemic. So check out that. It was a really good interview. The first one, David, Leisha, and I did jointly, and I think we did a pretty good job on it. So go check it out. Patreon.com/TMBS to support our work.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and then head into the fun half. We'll take some IMs. We'll try and take a couple of calls. Maybe I shouldn't even turn it on. I feel bad when people hold on to the phone thing and we don't get there. So let's just do IMs today. You can IM the show via majorityapp.com. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.